You're listening to a special showcase episode of the Round Table Podcast. 20 Minutes with Abigail Hilton.
Hi, everybody. I'm Brian Humphrey.
And I'm Dave Robison.
And you're listening to the Round Table Podcast and this week's 20 Minutes With.
20 Minutes With is an opportunity for Brian and I to sit down with the astonishing guest hosts that we have on the show and pick their brains, explore their craft, dig into what they do and how they do it to try and uncover the secrets of writing, which, Brian, I don't know if you follow Chuck Wendig's blog post, but the bastard actually gave away the secret of writing blog post. So we're hosed at this point.
Of course he did. Our
podcast has no meaning at all.
We can pack up and go home.
Exactly. But we're not going to do that, by
no.
golly. No, we're going to get into 20 Minutes With. And Brian, our guest for 20 Minutes With has a strange and mysterious past. No one's really sure where she comes from or how she got here. There's some speculation that she flopped gasping onto the beach of a tiny unnamed key off the Florida coast, devoured a seagull, wrapped herself into a gelatinous cocoon where she lay dormant for months and then emerged looking completely human.
Fabulous.
Now, another story claims that she was found as a young child wandering the orange groves of central Florida, living off of citrus and roadkill. She then adapted to life among... Yes, exactly. She became a voracious reader as she adapted to life among the humans, convinced her captors to send her to college, acquired several awesome degrees, settled on one where she keeps people alive while surgeons cut them open with sharp objects, which, of course, is the closest thing to magic that she's found in the world, and surgical caps hide her pointy ears.
And we all thank her for that, by the way.
Yeah, I'm telling you. Yeah, I met her at Balticon, and yeah, the surgical cap's good idea, because, wow, kind of freaky. her short fiction has appeared in Cast of Wonders, which, Brian, as you know, Alistair Stewart's involved with, and Cast Macabre, the amazing Dune Steef, the astonishing Drabble cast, and one that I hadn't heard of, but I will check out, The Greatest Uncommon Denominator. Her e-books, The Guild of the Cowrie Catcher series, The Prophet of Panamandora series, Crossroads, Short Stories of Panamandora, and a new one that just came out, Feeding Malachi, an illustrated children's chapter book. All are wrapped up in her gloriosity, her fabulosity, and her epicness. Ladies and gentlemen, join me in welcoming to the Skype line Miss Abigail Hilton. Abby, thank you for being on the show.
Hello. I feel already that I've been oversold. Like,
see, well, my work is done here because that is apparently my job here. And you know what I didn't mention? Is the epicness of your co-hosting of the awesome Fullcast podcast. Which,
that's true. We won a parsec.
Yes, absolutely, which is beyond awesome and well-deserved. The Fullcast podcast is definitely one of the first ones I tuned into and continue to check into regularly. So
it's Brian's baby. I just show up and flirt with people.
you're the what are you, the pod babe? Is that
that's
what that
it.
Is?
That's all I do.
Yeah, no, I've heard you on there. You know what you're talking about.
I listen to you guys. So I've listened to almost all of your shows.
Oh, wow.
Well, thank you.
Well, you and our guest writer, I think, and actually, no, we're gathering quite a crowd. That's awesome.
She's the audience member that
I'm your audience. About. So who's listening now?
Exactly. Well, and whoever's listening, let's go ahead and dive into our 20 Minutes With. I'm going to click the timer here. And what?
I said click.
Oh,
You're going to click the timer.
Now you're providing sound effects. You are my Foley
man.
You're
not the only one, Dave.
Is Brian your pod babe?
He is my pod. Yes.
I try.
Brian is my pod babe. And when we go to cons, we're going to dress him up in
a new title.
In a gold lamé bikini, and he's going to be awesome. Yes.
I am not cross-dressing.
Abby, nope, we're going to start.
Yeah, we're starting.
We're starting. Go. All right, let me reset the timer because that burned a minute. There we go. Abby, The Guild of the Cowrie Catchers, first of all, is an epic series, a multi-book series, and a very rich tapestry of world building, of character building, of story. And I wanted to ask, whenever a writer sits down, I mean, I think many of our listeners have these grand epic worlds that they're building and evolving to house their story. In the process of developing a story like this, surely you acquire a great vast amount of information before you even start writing. And I was curious, how do you parse out what you're going to deliver in the story without resorting to massive info dumps? Because you clearly know more than what the reader is getting. So how do you decide what to show when?
Well, I cheat a little bit because I do have chapter quotes, and those provide you with some background information. I have some people that just love that stuff. They eat it up. They always want more. It's never enough. They always want to know more about the world. And then I have some people, which I would say are more than half of the people, that really, really don't care. And they want to hear about the characters in the story. They could not care less about the minutia of the world and like the complex social structures in it, unless they apply to a character they're interested in. So I construct those things so that they'll give you a lot of information if you read them, but you don't have to read them. You can absolutely skip them. You'll still understand the story. You'll still understand what's going on. And my characters themselves pretty much don't give you much beyond what you need to know to understand what's going on, what's relative to them, to the viewpoint character.
Sure.
That you're with. So, yeah, that's kind of how I do that.
Okay, excellent.
So how do you make that determination, though? Because I find sometimes when I'm writing and I'm thinking, oh, they have to know this, they have to know this, they have to know this. And when it comes down to the wire, when I read back through it, I'm going, they don't need to know any of this crap. You know what I mean?
Well, that's so true. I mean, I take stuff out on rewrite. That's true. Yeah. I'm a cutter when I... that sounds terrible. When I... I'm not, really. I like myself.
Especially as an anesthetist.
I remove material when I edit. My books always get shorter on second draft. And often I'll be like, oh, I was talking to myself here. Here's where the author was talking to herself, deciding how this would work. Cut that. So yeah, I mean, there are places in my earlier drafts where I kind of run off at the mouth. But I try not to slow things down, and I do sometimes confuse people. I more often confuse people than I do bore people, and I would rather fall on that side of it. I would rather them want to know more than be like, oh, I really wish she had shut up.
Just get on with it. Yeah, I get that a lot, too. Just get on with it. Now the Cowrie Catcher series actually came out after The Prophet of Penamendora. Is that correct?
It did. Let's see. I wrote Prophet, and then I wrote an entire another epic after Prophet that came chronologically after it, and some of the quasi bad guys in that story called Walk Upon High were so interesting that I wanted to go back and tell how they became who they were in that story. Okay. And so that was Cowrie Catchers. And I have not released Walk Upon High because currently its plot is mutually exclusive with that of Cowrie Catchers. I changed some things in their backstory, and I need to rewrite Walk Upon High so that it will mesh.
Good Lord, your wall must be nothing but postcards and index cards and stuff.
I have a good memory. Really my only asset.
Oh, no. That's not entirely true.
So there was a whole novel in between those two books as far as me writing them. Chronologically, Cowrie Catchers is about, let's see, I think it's 10 years earlier in time than Prophet, but they hardly overlap, so you okay. Can't really tell. But as far as the order that I wrote them in, I wrote Prophet, I wrote an entire another epic, and then I wrote Cowrie Catchers. So if you notice a big difference in the quality of the writing, it's because my writing, you know, took a huge jump in between those things. And sure. Prophet was rewritten pretty extensively shortly before I wrote Cowrie Catchers. So it's not that big of a gap, but I think that most people that are paying attention would be like, wow, she got better in between these two books.
But the difference between those two is actually kind of what I want to talk about, because Prophet is a YA novel, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And Guild of the Coward Catchers most definitively is not.
No, it's not.
Now, did you run into an issue in terms of the fan base that you had evolved with Prophet of Panamandora not necessarily being able to transition into Cowrie Catchers?
There were definitely people that I lost. Not a lot, but a few.
Okay.
What
prompted you to make that? I mean, you clearly had a YA bent, and with Feeding Malachi, you've kind of returned to that emphasis on children's literature in the world that you've created. So what pushed you or motivated you to move into a more mature subject theme?
I write the stories that I have to tell, and I have lots of different stories. Okay. And some of them are for adults and some of them are for kids. I had four epic length pieces of fiction before I ever came to self-publishing or even podcasting.
Holy smokes.
I was just writing for my group of friends. I've always acquired an audience. It just happens. Like when I was in high school, people would come up to me and be like, so and so told me I should read your books, and I would give them a giant notebook, and they would give it back to me the next day and be like, I stayed up all night, would you give me another one? And so, you know, and that was how I made friends with people. Like that was how I made friends with people.
Bribing them with stories.
Yeah. So then they would feel like they knew me, which they kind of did. And so I always had like an audience of, you know, a dozen to 20 people who would read my stuff. And then I started releasing it via podcast and then later as ebooks. So it wasn't like I was like, oh, what would be a good marketing idea? I know, I'll write a YA novel and then I'll write another one in the same world with gay sex. That'll be a great marketing idea. I'm sure that there's people that won't recommend Prophet who otherwise would because they're afraid that someone will find Cowrie Catchers. But by and large, my audience is adult. I have found that I don't have that many people reading Prophet that it would be inappropriate for them to read Cowrie Catchers. There's not really that many. There's some that are offended, but that's their problem.
Well said.
But yeah, I definitely, that is an issue. I mean, that definitely comes up. I definitely have gotten the hate mail. I've definitely gotten the, you know, the mean letters. I had one person that was playing Prophet to their 6-year-old, and I wasn't really sure Prophet was appropriate for a 6-year-old, but, you know, I try to put lots of warnings in front of Cowrie Catchers, you know, just in case there's some parent playing it on vacation. Like, I don't see how. If you read the descriptions of Cowrie Catchers on the ebook site, and if you listen to my warning in front of the podcast, I don't see how you could be surprised. There are people that tell me they are. Like, I was shocked. Shocked. Like, did you ignore everything I said?
I told you will be offended. Holy crap.
But there are people that just won't be warned. But it's not most people. It's a small percent.
Good.
In the Cowrie Catchers, you're working with characters that have both human and animal characteristics, and you do a really interesting job of developing whole new races and the politics of the world and entire histories. Do you draw on anything within our own realm to look at certain groups and say, okay, this is very similar to the Fonz, or this is similar to, you know, and then how do you put those together? How do you bring those two together?
I mean, the natural world is more alien than aliens. there's nothing stranger than actual hyenas. Those are some weird ass animals. So, you know, and people are like, oh, that's so, this society you came up with. And I'm like, no, I drew that straight out of biology. I spent time in veterinary school. I was in vet school at Purdue. And then I decided that I would not be able to write novels and do that for a living probably. And so I left. And I ended up going into medicine instead, but I have a pretty extensive background in biology, and I have lots of veterinary textbooks lying around still. Most of my alien creatures are based on actual things in the real world.
We'll be back with more of our conversation with Abigail Hilton after this promotional break.
Good things come in 52s. There are 52 cards in a deck, 52 weeks in a year, the B-52s, There's this comic book reboot thing DC is doing. Okay, so there really aren't that many. But one thing that does come in a bundle of 52 is my ebook giveaway. This is the year of 52 weeks of indie. If you go to 52.scottroche.com, you'll see all the books I've given away, an excellent way to learn about new authors, and you can enter to win the ebook for the current week. It's usually as simple as dropping a comment on the blog, so if you'd like to win an ebook or just find out about some awesome independent authors, stop on by.
Now, let's get back to the conversation with Abigail Hilton.
So are you drawing more from the animal kingdom than from our own? In terms of when you're playing their characteristics and the politics, or how they interrelate to each other.
You're asking if there's like, here are the Germans, you know, that sort of thing.
Right, yeah. Or in this case, you know, like this is a terrible, terrible example, but there's a zoo in Nebraska, I guess, where they were putting together this cave exhibit and they had two different animals that never have existed before in nature together. Mm-hmm. And they just didn't have anywhere else to put them. And it was raccoons and like crocodiles or something like that.
And brilliant.
So the raccoons were going down and they were fishing at the edge of the water and the crocodile would come up and the raccoon would just knock it on the nose and it would turn around and swim away and they have never lost a raccoon.
Oh, geez.
Awesome. Because that relationship has never been established. And so I was curious, you know, if it is all like how animals relate to each other, that's fascinating. But just, you know, I was curious whether there was anything drawn from human politics or history.
Well, I'm a student of human nature. So, I mean, if it's not, I read somewhere, one of my favorite books when I was a kid was Watership Down. And I remember reading a review that said, this book is about people, even though it's about rabbits. And that, you know, that's always going to be true for the most part of things that fascinate us. It always is about people. And
sure.
I'm very interested in things like personality typing systems and, you know, what kind of traits usually go together. So there's definitely a lot of that. As far as like politics, I know more about, like, I'm very interested in the British Civil War. I have a bunch of books about the English Civil War because I'm fascinated by that period, the 1600s. I know way more about that than I do about, say, the Iraq War or possibly even World War One. So if you're asking, like, does this tie into like news and stuff like that? Not so much. But, you know, as far as being about human nature and the way I think we relate to each other and, I mean, you can say things, with non-human characters that will make people think that they would just simply shut down and shut out if you started talking about racial politics.
Absolutely.
You know, or gay politics, or women's stuff politics. Like people would just shut you out immediately because they already know what they think about that. But they will think about things that you say if they're in a kind of an alien context. I don't moralize, but there is stuff like that in my work.
Was that a conscious choice on your part? Because in most fantasy literature, there's usually a baseline. There's a human element. And then there are other races. Mm-hmm. And in your works, there are no human races. Everybody is alien. Everybody is a fantastical creature.
Yeah,
and was that a conscious choice on your part to distance the characters so much so that you could have sort of a venue to work with in that context?
No.
It was just cool?
That was sort of how it worked out. Yeah.
Well, you've been working on this for years. I mean, it sounds like you've been working on this since you were a kid.
I've worked in this world since I was about 16.
Okay. Okay. And so that aesthetic, that perspective kind of has informed the foundation of the story, and it being in your head as long as it has been, that's how it evolved.
Yeah. Yeah. And I definitely do run into difficulties where sometimes people have trouble visualizing my characters. Because they are not human, people can be surprisingly uncreative in their ability to visualize something that's unfamiliar to them. So, All of my creatures are derivatives of fawns. I kind of took the idea of a fawn and spun it out to other species of animals, and I called them all shelts, and then I split them up. So you've got hoofed shelts, and I call them fawns, and you've got pawed shelts, and I call them panons, and you've got shelts with neither hooves nor paws, like mermaids and selkies and stuff, and those are nons. So if we've got fawns, panons, and nons. And I think that's a pretty, coming from biology, I like taxonomy, but I think it's a pretty simple taxonomy. Sometimes it confuses people a lot. So I have illustrated books, and Cowrie Catchers is an illustrated series, and there are lots of pictures, and I found that alleviated most people's confusion.
Did you feel that was important for the story, or do you think the story would have stood on its own without the illustrations?
Oh, it does fine. I sell plenty of the non-illustrated complete series, too. I love comics. I love illustration. I love artwork. So it was something that I originally started buying just for me and my friends. And then when I started looking at releasing the books as a podcast, I was like, I don't think there are any illustrated podcasts. And look, I have this pile of pictures. So, yeah, there's that.
So you broke some new ground. You go, girl. Awesome. Now the storyline of Cowrie Catchers and your other works, you tend to create very layered and fairly intricate, extensive stories that you sort of dole out piecemeal as the story progresses, leading to a very engaging story process. So do you outline all of that at once? I guess what I'm really curious about is for a writer who would be interested in creating something up with that same epic feel of a much larger story, how do you go through that process of signposting the key elements and building a pacing and tempo to reveal that stuff in a good storyteller fashion?
Well, I personally think Prophet is too complicated. Okay. There was a book that came before Prophet, and it was fairly complicated. And then Prophet was like where I maxed out at having like all of these different characters doing different things at the same time, and we're jumping from group to group to group, and the politics behind who likes who and who has a grudge against who and who has a really nasty history with who, you know, those get fairly complicated. And you're going to enjoy the story more if you appreciate the tension between some of the characters, but if it gets too complicated, you forget where the tension where the lines of tension lie.
How do you draw that line? How do you gauge that?
People that can keep up with that story really enjoy it, but I made a conscious choice never to get that complicated again. So the one that came after that was in one person's point of view, didn't do nearly as much jumping around. Cowrie Catchers is almost exclusively in Gerard's point of view. It's a limited third person point of POV, and that really I find helps to ground it and keep it from getting too confusing. But for Prophet, absolutely, I had like this layered outline with like all like showing where so that one day didn't pass in one place while 5 days passes somewhere else. You know, that sort of thing. For Cowrie Catchers, when I start a story, I usually have the opening scene. I usually know where I'm going, and then I have several key points along the way that I'm excited to write. But there's several scenes in there that I'm like really excited to get to so I can write them. And that's pretty much all I know. So if it was an outline, it would be like the Roman numerals. And then I fill in the stuff that comes in between. And I usually get where I was planning to go. Sometimes I take some diversions, but that's kind of how it works.
When you were talking, I was thinking about the, you know, that your characters have these animal characteristics, and it seems to me that people have a tendency to attach themselves a lot more to animals than they do to people. We have no problem watching a movie where a bunch of people get, well, we do have a little problem, but not as much, where people get slaughtered. But if you see somebody do that to an animal or even kick a dog, you know, we freak out, and it affects us on a totally different level. Mm-hmm. Have you found that your readers get connected to the characters or maybe have a little more sensitivity to any violence that takes place where they get injured because they have animal characteristics?
I certainly play on that. I use that sometimes. On the other hand, people will accept certain kinds of violence from animals that they would... that would be out of bounds in a human story, even if it seemed realistic. So in Cowrie Catchers, you've got carnivorous species who actually sometimes eat they're right. So you've got like, you know, cat shelts, and they sometimes eat the deer shelts counterparts, and
the ones with the paws eat the ones with the hooves.
Yeah This it's not really cannibalism because they're not their own species, but right. You know, on planet Earth,
still it's kind of creepy. I mean, they're both sentient, right? It's
pretty close to cannibalism. I mean, as humans, we don't have more than one species that we can talk to on planet Earth, so right. We don't really know how we would treat, what ethical obligations we would feel towards another completely different species that was sentient. We don't know what that would be like. We don't know what our philosophers would come up with as our ethical obligations. But it's clearly, right. it's a little bit different, you know, than what they, their obligations that they feel towards their own species. And you know, because they do have some animal characteristics, people will accept certain kinds of violence that they wouldn't accept from a human being. But yeah, there's definitely some of the, you know, kicked puppy thing I will play right. out occasionally to
milk
turn
that for all
stomach
worth.
Or get their attention.
That's excellent.
Yeah. Fascinating.
I wanted to ask, you've been writing for a very long time, and as you've observed already, you are continuing to refine your craft. And I'm wondering, what are you working on now in terms of improving your writing mojo, and what are you doing to improve on that?
I'm doing something people tell you not to do.
Oh, good. That's always fun.
You know, Neil Gaiman said, don't look at the rules, because otherwise, you know, then you'll know what you can't do. I am rewriting my first novel. So this is a novel that I originally penned when I started this book when I was 14, and I finished it when I was 15, and it was like 250 or 300,000 words. So, you know,
I wrote
a
lot that year. that was the first book that I finished, and it got rewritten exhaustively in college. And was still not very good, and I'm glad that it has never been released anywhere. But the ideas in it were really cool, and there were some things in it that I never did again anywhere else. And all of the seeds of what became kind of my signature style were there. They were just kind of awkward. So, and it's also a story that has a very broad appeal. It's a pure animal story. It's like Jungle Book or, you know, Watership Down or something like that.
Okay.
And it's a book that would offend no one and would interest a lot of people, I think. So I basically went back and I will read a chapter, and then I will say to myself, what did this chapter do? What did it accomplish, you know, in terms of the story? How can I either do something different that's better or rewrite it in a way that's better told? And then I will just take it apart at the seams and completely rewrite it and make it better. In some cases, I've rearranged huge, like nothing's off the table. I can do anything. So in some cases, I've rearranged huge chunks of the story. But it feels like, I tell my friends, it feels like retelling a myth, because this is a story that many, many people, I mean, probably over 100 people read this story. And for some of my friends, it was part of their childhood too. Like, there was just something we talked about. And there's no point in making it something unrecognizable, because then I might as well just write another book. Right. So, you know, if you retell a myth, you have to work within the framework of the myth, but you are expected to delight and surprise even people who knew the original myth, right? Like, you're supposed to, you know, pull some tricks that nobody was expecting, even people that knew the original storyline. So, you know, I've got kind of that loose framework, and I'm trying to keep the things that were charming about the story, because there were some things that were legitimately charming and unlike things that I did later, you know, but remove all the teenage awkwardness from it. And I'm actually quite happy with how it's going. I've got about 85,000 words, and I'm guessing it'll come in somewhere between 150 and 200.
Holy
I'm hoping
smokes.
150. We'll see.
That's amazing. That's a bold and courageous step, really. I mean, to go back to your old work, because habitually, Brian, I don't know about you, but, you know, once I've written something, if it doesn't get shopped around or whatever, it kind of stays in the drawer and just kind of exists there as part of my past.
Yeah, even after it gets shopped around sometimes.
So pulling that up, that's awesome.
I kept thinking about it, and if I keep thinking about it, it usually means that I should should lay it to rest.
There's
something
there for
you. The only way to lay it to rest is to is to make it available. I am releasing that book chapter by chapter on my website.
Oh, wow.
So not only am I releasing it chapter by chapter, I have comments with each chapter that talk about how this changed from the original, why I made these changes, what I think it says about me as a teenager, that I had this in the story to begin with. Like, I deconstruct it in the comments.
An exhaustive expose. That's
so, and then, you know, that version is unedited. And when I'm completely finished, I will release a more polished, edited version that will be for sale. But yeah, you can read it for free online. Awesome. It's called Hunters Unlucky. It's on my website.
And cool. First of all, that's beyond awesome. And second of all, give our listeners the URL for that awesome website.
It's abigailhilton.net.
That's easy enough to remember. We'll make sure that gets in the liner notes, too. And on that note, I see that the clock has not only spun down, but it's dead. It's sitting there on my desk going, I have expired. So we have to wrap up. But Abby, this has been fascinating. You know, once we're done here, let's stay on the phone and we'll talk a little bit more about all this cool stuff. But we need to let our listeners go for now. Brian, any closing words as we jette off to Coolsville here?
Go write characters with animals.
There you go.
And don't hurt them too bad.
That's right. And Abby, thank you so much. This has been a real delight. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Friends, thank you as always for tuning in. We greatly appreciate that as well. Show us some love out there at the iTunes site. Drop a few words if you're feeling in the writing mood on the post on the website, www.roundtablepodcast.com. Heck, you know, drop us an email, thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. We'd love to hear from you. And Brian already said it. It's time to go right. So
yeah.
Come back in a couple of days. We'll have Abby back and we'll workshop a very cool vampire story set back in the ancient days. That's all I'm going to say about it. Shameless tease that I am.
I'm so excited.
Oh, I know. It's going to be great fun. You're going to love this. But until then, you guys stay cool. We appreciate you so very, very much. Be good until then. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com. Or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast. Or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.